Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. And welcome to Mother's Day at the Table. I've been part of enough communities over the course of my adult life to know that there are many different things we could have done this morning. And I feel a bit like I'm walking on a tightrope personally today, because honoring mothers is about as worthy an endeavor as I can think of. And it can also be an alienating one. It can create, pretty easily, it can create a sense of distance or ostracization for people whose relationship with the idea or the experience of motherhood has been a challenging one, or whatever. There's a constellation of reasons, of course, that make that complex. So I want to view this particular marking of Mother's Day, at least initially, as being from far away rather than close up. And we'll get to close up at the end. So if that's what you want or that's what you feel like you need, just stay with me. But along the way, I hope that we can make space to think about mothers and motherhood on this day, in this context, in some ways that can invite all of us to participate. So the title, for those of you who see these things in the blurb or online, the title for today's Talky Bit is An Infinite Debt. And we don't usually think about debt in positive terms, maybe especially if we've, you know, recently incurred a large debt. We've bought a house, would be maybe a fairly stereotypical version of that. We have some other ongoing financial obligation. It could be a relational one for that matter, but something we think about as indebtedness. And I'd like to adjust that a bit, at least in this context. But it's going to take us a little while to get there. So in the meantime, let me offer what I hope can be a bit of a guiding metaphor. Metaphors are one of the preferred tools for people whose exploration of their beliefs has taken them on a journey away from certainty and toward mystery, in really broad terms. And one of the reasons why folks in that sort of part of a process or journey like metaphors is because metaphors are roomy. I heard someone describe them this morning, actually. I wasn't looking for them to be talking about metaphors. They were speaking about new science on whether we should think about plants as intelligent, burgeoning conversation, and quite a fascinating one, and extremely controversial within the scientific community because plants have no brain. Can something without a brain have a mind, right, and so on. So the ripple, the philosophical ripple just goes out right away. But
they always speculate about that in science fiction.
Exactly. And so is it just need to stay in science fiction, or is this, you know, and so anyway, the real scientists, if you will, are messing with this in some fascinating ways. And so this person was talking about how metaphors can help us think about this. And they talked about how metaphors kind of use the real to help us approach the mysterious. And I thought that was a pretty good description of metaphors and why they matter. So I want to offer us this metaphor. It might help if you think about this as an imagined experience, all right? I would invite you, again, as you're comfortable, but I'd invite you to close your eyes, unless you're listening to this on the podcast and you're driving, in which case, close your mind's eye a little bit, and picture this that way with me. So imagine this with me. I want you to imagine a calm pond or a lake. Any surface of water that has that curious sense of being stretched tight. What we mean by surface tension, where you can sort of see it. It's so calm that it feels like
feels like you can see the Saran wrap over creation. It, not in a rigid, frozen way, but in a very dynamic and changing one, like the smooth water above a set of rapids or above a waterfall before it gets turbulent. And what you're looking at is full of power, but it's latent power. It's weighty, but the power is mostly hidden. It's beneath the surface. And there are some hints at what lies beneath, but they're just that. They're hints, they're clues, they're maybe occasional glimpses, they're small deflections in the smoothness. And you're standing on the bank, and you have a pebble in your hand. And the question you realize you're asking yourself is, to disturb or not to disturb? Should I throw this in there? It's peaceful like this. But also, if I threw it in, what difference would it really make? The water is going to go back to being peaceful again shortly after you toss the pebble, right? So, you toss it in. And the surface responds to your tossed pebble. It ripples. If it was a clean toss and a fairly uniform pebble, what I like to think of as a bloop into the smooth surface, the ripples might be quite uniform. These concentric circles that travel outwards from the point of intersection. Perhaps if you're near the shore, some of them might visibly come close to your feet before they're altered by the bank, but some of them run off in other directions, somehow joining the mystery beneath the surface, perhaps even before they're out of your sight. All right. Depending how far away you went, you can wiggle your fingers and come back. If we don't stop to think about this, we might well assume that once we can no longer see the surface version of those ripples, the effect of the pebble toss is over and done. Now, don't try to make that argument with any mathematician that works with chaos theory, the field of study that has to do with trying to predict the behavior of things that are inherently unpredictable, like long-term weather. How's that for setting out on your life work? I'm going to study how we could predict things that are unpredictable. Here we go, right? But that's chaos theory in lots of ways. The very short version of that branch of math and science is an idea that's commonly called the butterfly effect. And we often hear it talked about, you know, the butterfly flaps its wings in North America and it causes an avalanche in Peru. Like, you know, those kind of illustrations. And those illustrations don't tend to be random. They come from the history of this study. The phrase itself, butterfly effect, comes from a particular scientist, a person named Edward Lorenz. Lorenz was a meteorology professor at MIT. And in the 60s, he was studying weather patterns and the relationships between weather patterns, how this storm's impact might be felt on this other possible storm. And I don't want to get stuck here, but I want to have this point us toward what I think is a rather important idea, so I'm going to unpack it a little bit. So when Lorenz started his work, and what has since grown into chaos theory, where he kind of began, this is a bit of an oversimplification, but in some ways the idea behind all of this complex stuff is everything is connected, and even small actions can have great impact. Lots of this, not least of all because the research started in the realm of weather, has continued to kind of work with some of that. A scientist named Alessandro Filazzola, a Canadian, or at least a Canadian context there, a community ecologist, a data scientist, postdoc fellow at the University of Alberta, and they're an academic who works sort of at that intersection of chaos theory and climate change. It's kind of interesting, right? Because if you get into climate change resistors, deniers, people who kind of go, nope, not a real thing, whatever we want to think of that position as, one of the arguments you encounter right away is that you can't sort of demonstrate causal relationships in this. We can sort of see something's happening, but maybe it's the same something that happened a couple of millennia ago. So maybe it's cyclic and so on and so forth, right? So we start to bump into this problem right away in that conversation. But he says, that's what he studies, the intersection of chaos theory and climate change. And he says about the implications of these ideas on the choices we make as individuals. So this is his life work, is studying this stuff. And he's like, I start to think about me and my choices. And he says it this way. He says, the items I buy the people I interact with, the things I say, I believe can each have their cascading effects that ripple through society. That's why it's important to try to be a good person, to create a positive influence. One thing I also think about is how these indirect effects are often not as small and removed as I believe many would think. Probably not that surprising a perspective from somebody who spends all day every day studying chaos theory and the possible connections between things that we can't necessarily demonstrate connections between, right? He's immersed in this. All to say this, our pebble tossing, however we think of that metaphor in our lives, might reach further than we can ever imagine. Now, about Mother's Day. And I'm going to stay in the realm of deeply influential thinkers about science for a moment here. Johannes Kepler, not everybody's t-shirt scientist necessarily, that would be Einstein, because of the hair, right? But this is like 1571 to 1630 was when Kepler lived. Quite possibly one of the greatest scientific minds that we know of in the history of Western thought. This is the person who helped to basically blow up the idea that Earth was the center of the universe well before, sort of a contemporary of Galileo, maybe more of their father, but also knew Galileo, well before Galileo had the nerve to speak of it, right? So they were working with these ideas before Galileo was. This is the person who basically invented science fiction as a genre in the process. We'll talk more about that in a moment. They described the effects of gravity decades before Newton formalized it as law. They imagined speech synthesis centuries before computers were invented, and they envisioned space travel over 300 years before anybody landed on the moon. We have documentation of all of their work, substantial documentation of all of their work on all of those. He was also quite possibly one of the least lucky people I've ever read about. Just had an absolutely horrendous collection of life experiences. So much personal tragedy. All right. I said I'd make a connection to Mother's Day. Hang in there. I'm going there. So Kepler's inspiration for becoming an astronomer was that when he was 6 years old, his illiterate mother, Katharina Kepler, took him outside to a hilltop one night to watch the great comet of 1577 blaze across the sky. And it's too long a story to recount here, but the very short version is that that experience led Kepler to a lifetime of study. First of all, in preparation to be a member of the clergy, but then when his imagination proved too unsettling for the church, he turned to science. And the results of that study changed the world as people then knew it and deeply informed the world as we still know it. Kepler produced, among many other things, a work of science fiction called, in English, The Dream, which he hoped would help people's imaginations awaken to a different view of the Earth's place in the universe. And again, very short version, there's a race that lives on the moon, but they're not colonizers. They're just there. That's their home. And their view of the universe, because their vantage point is the moon and not Earth, is totally different than the Earth's understanding of the universe in terms of planetary motion and so on. But they believe that it's the whole story of the universe. And so in the novel, that kind of comes to be seen to not be the whole story, because Earth's point of view comes into that, right? So that, there you go, there's a quick outline. It's worth remembering that at this point in European history, when Kepler writes this, Kepler is inhabiting a world in which, essayist Maria Popova puts it this way, he's writing this in a world where, quote, God is mightier than nature, and the devil realer and more omnipresent than gravity. So this is a world that is rife with superstition. During Kepler's lifetime, it produces witch hunts that cost the lives of tens of thousands of people in Europe, as interestingly distinct from the dozen people that got killed in Salem, which is North America's sort of synonym culturally and historically for witch hunts, right? It's a tiny little thing compared to Europe. Tens of thousands of people, most of them women, are killed in this process. This is a period of history where those superstitions, largely religious, lead to the 30 Years' War, which is the deadliest religious war in the continent's history. And during which, same period of history, there's lots going on here, during which the Inquisition in Rome declares that emerging theories about the Earth's movement, Kepler's work, Galileo's work, are a heresy punishable by death. So Galileo's lucky, he just gets locked up, right? He just gets consigned to house arrest. Because from the vantage point of the church, which is interwoven with the state, you don't get to talk about any other ideas about the earth, other than the earth is the center of the universe and planetary motion is symmetrical and concentric. That's the deal. Say something other than that, we'll kill you. You're a heretic. You're undermining the foundation of good belief. Now, Mother's Day. Among the women charged with being witches was Katharina Kepler, Johannes Kepler's mom. And the reason that she was charged was because of her son's novel, which he described as an attempt at gently waking people from a millennia-long commitment to an inaccurate understanding of the Earth's place in the universe. He was like, maybe a story. Maybe the hard science is too hard. Let's write a novel. Let's call it fiction. It's so disruptive to the majority's view of the world, of the universe and the Earth's place in it, their view of God, that the blame had to go somewhere. We do this, right? I was in Michael's. I don't frequent Michael's, but Taya needed something. I was in Michael's on Friday, and I walk in, and I hear somebody in the store on their cell phone saying loudly enough, Michael's is huge, right? It's a gigantic barn of a place. They're like a couple of aisles over, and I can hear them clear as a bell. My phone's nice and clear. The problem is your phone. My phone's fine. I'm like, that's not exactly the way that works. And then they repeated it a few minutes later. So clearly, right, the blame has to go somewhere is my point, right? When we're having a disruptive experience, we want a story that explains it. In this particular story, Kepler's novel is deeply disruptive. The blame has to go somewhere. It goes to the scientist's mother. Now, Katharina Kepler spends the next 5 years of her life living under the cloud of this accusation of being a witch. And she lives in a relatively small German town before she's finally arrested. She gets carried naked from her house in the middle of the night. Some stories say that the soldiers that came to get her, the officers just picked her up and took her out. Others say that they carried her out in a wooden box that she was hiding in, which she'd hidden when she heard them coming. But either way, she gets violently and abruptly removed in an undignified way from her home. She gets threatened with being tortured on the wheel, sort of a, you know, the circular version of the rack, unless she admits to the charge of being a sorceress. Kepler doesn't live there. He's far away. He's in Leipzig, I think, at this point, doing his research. He's about 500 kilometers away, which, horse and buggy, you know, like it's a long ways. Now, in the weeks before Katharina Kepler's arrest, 6 women in this little German town where she lives have been burned at the stake, accused of that same thing. Her defense now falls to her son. And she's now in her 70s, she's lived well beyond the typical lifespan for that era. She spends the next 14 months in a dark room, sitting and sleeping on a stone floor to which she is shackled with a heavy iron chain. It's a brutal story. Johannes Kepler, eventually prevails in this process by showing how all the stories used to accuse his mother have a basis in fact, not in superstition. It's a fascinating and deeply disturbing story, but a couple of quick examples. I don't want us to get lost in here. There's quite a string of them. But for example, one of the accusers is a local butcher who says she's clearly a witch because when I walked past her in the street, I felt a sudden pain in my hip. What else could that be but sorcery, right? Turns out he has lumbago. There is a perfectly rational explanation for the pain in his hip. The rumors are started by a disaffected friend of Katharina Kepler's who, as it turns out, became pregnant by somebody not her husband, had a secret abortion, was trying to keep the whole thing a secret. Katharina knew the story. She could discredit Katharina. She wouldn't have to answer for this, and so on. And there's just a string of these that Kepler kind of does the homework on and offers to the judiciary as evidence that these are not evidence of sorcery at all. They're actually quite logically explained things. Yeah, fascinating and disturbing. He prevails. His mom is released from prison. She dies shortly after that. She never recovers from that travail. But she has, in the meantime, faced both the accusations and the threats with what apparently was typical self-possession, and she has confessed to nothing. She's like, no, I'm not a sorceress. I'm an old widow living here in Whatever your experiences you're having. They're not about me. Kepler, Johannes Kepler, holds himself responsible. And he wonders, not about his ideas, which he has repeatedly demonstrated with solid science, but about whether he should have ever tried to help people wake up and change their thinking about the view of the world. And he writes this: I know a woman who was born under almost the same aspects, with a temperament which was certainly very restless, but by which she not only has no advantage in book learning, brackets, this is not surprising in a woman, close brackets, but also disturbs the whole of her town and is the author of her own lamentable misfortune. In other words, she talked about the story and brought these problems on herself. And in the next sentence, which could sound like blame, and that's not Kepler's point at all. He's going somewhere else with this, so just stay with me. In the next sentence, he makes it clear that the woman he's writing about is, in fact, his mother. And then he notes that she has not enjoyed the privileges, in terms of education and sway in society, that he has. I mean, there's a reason why she can't defend herself, right? Any of these women that were accused of witchcraft, their defense fell to their male counterpart, their spouses, their sons, their brothers, as long as they were men. And he says this about that. He says, quote, I was born a man, not a woman. A difference in sex which the astrologers seek in vain in the heavens. And he goes on to say that the difference between the fates of the sexes is not to be found in the heavens, but in the earthly construction of gender as a function of culture. It's worth remembering that Kepler wrote that in the early 1600s. We're still working with Kepler's ideas. His exploration changed what we believe. But it started with his mother, whose restless curiosity and adamant refusal to bow down before the unfounded superstitions and cultural biases of her time prompted her to take her 6-year-old kid out stargazing one night. Bloop. Right? It started with a pebble toss. But the cost. Which brings me to the quote. If you get the blurb, you probably noticed that title, An Infinite Debt. That's taken from a quote by the deeply influential English pediatrician and psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott. Winnicott died in the early 70s, 1971. This Winnicott was, among other things, there's lots to argue with in his work, of course, and many of the ideas have sort of unfolded subsequently in his practice, his field of practice. But he was, among other things, an early pioneer of the notion of good enough parenting, as distinct in his work from prescriptive or punitive perfection as a goal. And he just believed that good enough parenting was the foundation of a healthy upbringing. So he was kind of an early voice in that regard. And writing about the need for society to robustly recognize what he calls the immense contribution to the individual and to society made by what he calls the ordinary good mother, simply by virtue of that person's devotion to the child, particularly in the early stages of infancy, he asks this question: is not this contribution of the devoted mother unrecognized precisely because it is immense? And he's not saying that that excuses us when we don't recognize it, but rather that the sheer magnitude of that contribution, the ripples from that contribution, are so substantial that we sometimes might not even know how to properly credit them. We get stuck. The blame has to go somewhere. Where do we put it? The ripples also go somewhere. How do we credit them? He goes on to say this, and here's where we actually get to where I pulled the quote from. If this contribution, the immensity of this contribution that he's talking about, if this contribution is accepted, it follows, this is pretty strong, it follows that every man or woman who is sane, every man or woman who has the feeling of being a person in the world, for whom the world means something, every happy person, is in infinite debt to a woman. So, There are lots of places we could go from there. There are some I wish to avoid, if possible, including that of sort of crawling into the shame cave to lick the wounds of our guilt if we don't think we've adequately or perhaps ever acknowledged this contribution. We may have failures to acknowledge, but as an aside, shame is rarely a productive response. There's more helpful options available. If you're listening to this on the podcast, I'm about to describe the exercise we're going to do and what will lead up to it, and I would encourage you to engage in something similar in your own setting if you wish and find that you're able to do so. For those of us that are here, I'm going to invite us to consider what we might do, either within ourselves or as an embodied action, to acknowledge our own infinite debt. I wrestled with this. I really did. I don't offer this suggestion or opportunity lightly. I realize that it might be enormously complicated for all sorts of reasons, and this might not be the moment for any particular person to engage in this. So, as always, at the table, an invitation. But I sincerely hope that I can frame this in a way that, even just by saying it, that nobody feels like you need to do this. For some of us, it might be hard to know who to name to such a role. Or we may have been nurtured most meaningfully by a person or by persons who were not, at least biologically speaking, our mothers. And so many other possibilities. So, again, as you're able. Here's a thought, not original with me, but that I found helpful. Whoever we think of when we think of mother, that person is probably neither a saint nor a savior. They are most likely a person who, however messy or difficult our childhood may have been, however complicated our adult relationship with them might be, they're probably someone who loved us the best way they knew how with the tools they had and the cards they were dealt. I've mentioned this here before. I find it a helpful metric in my own life. One of my therapist friends likes to say, how would it change the way you understand this story if that person was actually doing the best that they could? It's a pretty great question, right? Not an easy question, but a compelling one. Playwright, suffragist, psychologist Florida Scott Maxwell describes this difficult task of trying to balance intimacy and independence when she writes, quote, "It's not easy to give closeness and freedom, safety plus danger." Dependence, interdependence, and independence, if you want a different sequence, right? It's a balancing act. Maybe it's because of the ages of our kids, but I feel like I'm consciously doing that balancing act every day, all day, right now as a parent. So when we think of the complex possibility of acknowledging our infinite indebtedness, as Winnicott points to it, maybe that'll help. I'm not sure, but I offer it to you. So here's what I want to invite us to consider as an exercise today. I'm going to put up a lovely and I think very interesting video. It's called My Mother's Eyes, and it's an animation. The animator, creator, illustrator, and director is somebody named Jenny Wright. Jenny's personal story around this piece was she was midway through her university studies at Central St. Martin's College in London as an illustrator. That's what she was studying when her mother died. And she took her grief and she channeled it into this little 5-minute film, which became her master's thesis. If it wasn't so powerful, I'd be like, I think I could do that. I couldn't do that. There's a lot distilled in this little film. She describes it as, quote, "a story about motherhood and loss in an abstracted world of childhood memory." So the abstracted, I wanted to mention that description because the abstracted idea is an important one in the context. If you're listening to the podcast, you can find this film on Vimeo. You can also find it by looking up her own site, hellojennywright.com, where there's some other short works of hers worth looking up. All right. So here's what we're going to do in space here. I'm going to show us the film. There are index cards and all kinds of different writing things here on the table. You're welcome to help yourself to some of those before we start. I would encourage that if you think you're interested in reflecting in a more permanent way on what you might do to engage with that indebtedness that I described, or something akin to it, or prompted by it, And I'm offering those instead of just saying pull out your phone, because different parts of our brain get lit up when we actually use our hands to think, as well as our screens. And so I just, that's on offer if you want it. So we'll watch the video, and then I'm just going to give us some time in silence to consider what might be our best way to acknowledge our infinite debt and to whom. And the rest, essentially, I leave to you to, I hope, go in peace and reflect on and enact.